The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, where we ask you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and with me is on-air producer, Sean Wimet.
Howdy.
So, occasionally I see people wearing shirts that say, I read your email, and I always wonder if they do. And maybe not them specifically, but someone is probably reading your email. But why? What exactly are they doing with that information? If it's just someone hanging out in a coffee shop with some time on their hands, that's one thing. But what if it's for more nefarious purposes? Is it my credit card number they're after? Can someone steal my identity and blame me for their unsavory doings? Can they teach me how? So today we'll be talking about cybersecurity with expert Null Session, about why using the same password for everything makes you not only uncreative, but kind of an idiot. But first, let's do a bit of speaking up. So, is it possible to accurately measure someone's intelligence? And if we can, what does that mean? This week, we have Rodrigo de Ligera in studio with us to talk about IQ denialism. Rodrigo is the Mensa Proctor for Northern Alberta, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut. And for those of you who don't know, Mensa is a society for people with high IQs. So, welcome to Skeptically Speaking.
Hi.
So what's this all about then?
Well, there's something analogous that has existed even before global warming denial, which I would call IQ denial. IQ denial ranges from denying the practical importance of IQ to outright denial that IQ tests measure intelligence or anything real. Like the global warming denial or the creationism evolution controversy, the IQ denial controversy exists almost exclusively in the media instead of in the scientific community. At the root of all these controversies is dogmatism, whether religious or political. In essence, people don't like the religious or political implications of the science, and so therefore reject the science instead of just the politics. One of the biggest controversies, especially in the light of the book The Bell Curve by Herrnstein and Murray, was over racial differences in IQ. Unfortunately, they muddied the waters by coming to political conclusions based on the data, and when people reacted badly to those conclusions, they took swipes at the science too. One book that was championed as the antidote to their book was Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man. Unfortunately, while Gould was an excellent writer, he sometimes made bad arguments, and this book has some of them. For example, the fact that Bert might have been a racist and fudged some numbers is not a conclusive argument against IQ correlations in twin studies. That would be like arguing that Isaac Newton's work in physics and mathematics was worthless because he was an occultist and he fudged some numbers on astronomical observations. Subsequent research by other scientists showed that Bert's numbers were essentially correct. It has still not been determined that the racial differences in IQ are genetic instead of environmental, even though IQ is about 75% determined by genetics. I personally think that the racial differences might be caused by nutrition instead. Another accusation of IQ tests is that they only predict how well you do on IQ tests. That's false. Although the correlations are moderate, there's nothing in psychology that has better predictive value than IQ for school and job performance. The correlation between IQ scores and grades is 0.5. Naturally, there are things like motivation that might have an even greater role in school performance, but that varies tremendously and cannot be measured like IQ can. For job performance, the more complex the job, the more it correlates. And one way of knowing that IQ tests are largely not biased is that they predict these things equally well regardless of race, sex, and modern culturally fair ones can even predict how tribe members will rank each other in terms of hunting or gathering abilities. Even something as easy as safe driving ability is predicted by IQ. People with low IQ have about 3 times the traffic accidents that people with higher IQs have. IQ even correlates with things that have a moral dimension, like having legitimate children or being incarcerated. Anyway, due to the rash of misinformation being spewed by journalists, some of the leading intelligence researchers signed an open letter in the Wall Street Journal in 1994 trying to set the record straight on IQ. There will be links to this and other references in the blog.
Absolutely. So I didn't realize what a contentious issue this really was until you approached me with the show idea. So let's start with the non-contentious first. So does IQ actually change throughout your life?
Yeah, it can. Between the ages of about 11, 12 to 17, it's about maybe 7 points change, but it could be as high as 18. And generally, in terms of the genetic component, your IQ goes to what it should be predicted to be, more when you're an adult in middle age instead of when you're a child.
So can you actually improve your own IQ?
There's limited things you could do. I think nutrition is really important, but short-term changes in nutrition really don't do much. But then again, if you think about height, for example, you know, short-term changes in how well you eat doesn't change your height very much. But if, you know, over a child's lifetime, you feed them well, I think that, you know, IQ will go up, in fact.
Okay, well, you said that that 70% of IQ is genetic as opposed to environmental. And you just mentioned nutrition. And that would make sense to me because I've seen other studies that that have made a correlation between nutrition and school performance.
Okay.
Which is why we have things like school breakfast programs and hot lunch programs. But what are some of the other environmental factors that could affect IQ?
Well, there's a bunch of theories. In fact, I read a book trying to explain the rise in IQ scores of 3 points per decade. It's been happening since IQ tests have been created. So basically, children nowadays could be considered, you know, gifted on their grandparents' IQ tests. And there's various theories in that book. There's TV, for example, that might give more stimulation. Even things like cereal boxes with puzzles in the back. Nutrition, of course, is another one. Yeah, there's various explanations that might possibly explain some of it.
Okay. You also mentioned that you say that IQ correlates with being incarcerated, and I'm assuming you mean lower IQ.
Yeah, the higher your IQ, the less chance you have of being incarcerated.
Okay, so what kinds of crimes did the incarceration studies take into account? Like, did they look at white-collar crime?
I am not sure. I just saw a summary table. But the difference is quite startling, though, the extremes. If I remember correctly, with the dull normal people, it was maybe around 7% or something. I could be completely wrong. But at the high level, like above 130 or so, there's virtually a zero incarceration rate.
Okay, well, because if we look at things like fraud, which is a white-collar crime, and that takes a certain amount of intelligence, like a Bernie Madoff kind of issue. How do you account for that?
Well, another thing...
I'm assuming it's just that it's not that intelligent people don't do crime. It's that intelligent people don't get caught.
That's okay. That's what your point might have been. But if you look at the other figures, though, for out-of-wedlock births, divorces and so forth, that's a bit harder to hide whether you're divorced or not. And those things are also, I would say, in the moral dimension. And there might be, because one of the things about intelligence is they found something called G, the general factor, and it seems that it affects all kinds of mental processing. It's possible that there might be some more retardation that happens as well as, you know, general IQ reduction and everything else. So
that gets into a whole other conversation about moral relativity. One thing we haven't mentioned is socioeconomic status. And a lot of the criticism of IQ tests have come from the race issue.
Yeah.
Could you attribute some of the difference in the racial results or the results based on race to socioeconomic factors?
Definitely. I think if you're poor, you will eat cheaper foods, which are usually less nutrition and more, you know, empty calories. If you do that, then your IQ would be reduced from what I think in terms of, bad nutrition, lower IQ. And then it generates a cycle, of course. You know, their children are also going to be in a low socioeconomic situation because, that it affects how much education you get, and education affects what kind of jobs you have. What kind of job you have affects your socioeconomic status as an adult. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole cycle that happens, I think, because of that. So
absolutely. But there's also, there's been a lot of criticism about the test itself being culturally biased.
Yeah, and there was some research, especially done by Jensen, who was a leftist, and he started out thinking, oh, for sure they're biased and so forth. And one thing to remember is that the fact that different groups have different scores is not the evidence that they're biased. What you have to do is see whether those scores actually predict accurately external things that have external validity, like job performance or school performance and so forth. And he studied this very carefully, and he found out that sure, there might be some questions which might be not in the experience of some people. And I myself have seen some bad questions, like, for example, asking me like flower names or something. I mean, I don't even know them now that I'm an adult. But those, you know, those things have been worked on as well, and there's culturally fair tests now that are being administered. So yeah, it's a small factor. But generally, in a large IQ test, are not biased if you belong to the culture and have the language that the test is targeted at, I guess.
So if IQ is a predictor, what do we want to use that information for?
Well, the original intent of the IQ test was to be able to find out which children needed special education. Binet in France made up the first IQ test, and he tested things like, for example, can they tie their shoes? Can they determine whether one weight is heavier than another? Things like that. And, of course, it became more and more paper-based. But that was the original test, and that was the original intent of the IQ test. But subsequent research has found that it has so many other correlates and outside of just, you know, schoolwork.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for Speaking Up today. Rodrigo, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
And listeners, if you want to do a bit of speaking up, send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line. Give us a brief rundown of what science or skeptical topic you'd like to talk about, and we'll contact you.
It always helps to bribe us with compliments as well.
Also, yes. Yes, yes, very important. Good point, Sean.
Yep.
And we will be back in a bit with cybersecurity. Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time at 780-492-2577 extension 1. That's 780-492-2577 extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Skeptically Speaking is also rebroadcast on Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show. You're back with Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'd like to point out that the station affiliates list that was just mentioned in that ad is now incomplete. We have a new station rebroadcasting the show, Rossland Radio 101.1 FM in Rossland, British Columbia. And interestingly, that is our first Canadian affiliate. And that's interesting. I don't know why. The Americans love us. And we appreciate that, Americans. And hopefully Canadians will now.
America, you're okay, too.
Yeah.
You're not so bad.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
No, we like you. You host Ham. How can you beat that?
Absolutely. So do check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com for more details. So today, we're going to be talking about hackers, internet anonymity, industrial espionage, and what us little people can do to protect ourselves. And with us is Null Session. Are you there, sir? Hello?
Yes, here.
Hello, Null Session. He has quite the background. He's a nuclear physicist turned cybersecurity expert, coming from Los Alamos National Lab, and now keeping the bad guys out for a multinational corporation on the Fortune 100. He's involved with national infrastructure security. He serves on various industry advisory boards, and he's currently the regional education chair for IEEE, the world's leading organization for the advancement of technology. He's an adjunct professor, and he helped organize the All Things Cryptography and Information Security Related RSA conference. This is a lot of acronyms, sir. Mm-hmm. Next week, he'll actually be speaking on two panels at Black Hat, the world's premier technical security gathering in Las Vegas. So we're actually using Null Session's Twitter name, both to avoid potential employer liability and because Null Session sounds really cool. So first of all, you were a nuclear physicist. Why the career change?
Path of least resistance.
Nice.
I had an opportunity. You know, when you work in experimental physics, you work with electronics, you work with computers, and this was in the early 90s. Setting up computer networks was something that we all did, and so I had an opportunity to manage computer security and the network for the theoretical division at Los Alamos, and I took the opportunity. It meant I didn't have to move and do anything difficult, so it was very interesting. I find that computer security and other areas of science rely on a person being a good skeptic, being logical, being a good problem solver, and you know, it is kind of cool to be working in cybersecurity.
Absolutely. So actually, you mentioned before the show that you are purely white hat. So what does that mean?
Well, let's see. I think that there are the origins of sort of the hacker mythos came from probably the 1960s when programmers working at universities, working for the government, developing code on very big, very expensive computers, would, you know, basically get their geek on, right? They would stay up late. They would be figuring out all the ways that they could do different things. It was a way to satisfy sort of the geek curiosity. And, you know, they didn't have Warcraft. They didn't have you know, the fancy computers we have today. They had simple breadboards and green screen computers. And, you know, they really learned how to make the most with what they had. And
hello again.
I'm back.
Hi.
I'm back.
Hello, sir. All right.
My son's playing Warcraft, I think.
And can we blame him?
Yeah, we can blame him.
The cybersecurity expert didn't lock out the whole network for the hour of the show. I find that interesting.
Okay, so I understand. The last part was, I believe, get their geek on?
Okay, so hackers in the 60s would, you know, spend a lot of time making the most out of the equipment that they had at the time, which isn't very sophisticated compared to what we have today. I was saying that this was before Dungeons and Dragons, before Warcraft, and, you know, you want to go someplace mysterious and figure out all the rules, find your way around, you know, the maze of electronics or the phone system or whatever at the time. That was a very intellectual pursuit. I think that over time, the idea of a hacker has evolved maybe into something that's more malicious. And so Black Hat really refers to the malicious element out there, and White Hat sort of refers to those who are curious but a little more ethically upstanding, I guess.
Have you ever thought about going over to the dark side?
No.
Oh, there was some hesitation there.
I think there's enough need out there for people who are good at what they do and ethical. There's no real need to lose integrity and go over to the dark side.
How very Obi-Wan of you.
Yes.
This is going to be a show full of nerd references, isn't it? It really is.
I think so.
I love this program.
It's hard not to.
Is that the definition of the show?
So, Null Session, how anonymous can you really be online?
Well, one never knows. There are entities that operate offshore, outside of the jurisdiction of what we would consider the good governments. There are some governments that are anti-U.S. And then there are people who operate out in international waters. And they'll provide services that will anonymize what you do. And there's always a question of, if you use these anonymizers, you know, is there still a way to track it back to you? And it would really take a big effort for a government, I think, to be able to do that. I'm not saying that that's not possible.
Right.
You're probably safe from the average criminal, though. So a person can set their proxy to be anonymous. You can run your traffic through... I have Firefox, for example, set up to go through a proxy in Mexico right now. So if somebody's monitoring my activity, all of my activity appears to be going to one IP address in Mexico.
Right.
So it makes it harder to track back. It doesn't make it impossible. Plus, when you're going to web pages, most web pages aren't encrypted. And so unencrypted web pages can be sniffed over the network. So if your ISP happens to be capturing traffic, monitoring what you're doing, or the government, or whomever, then that can be tracked. And if you follow links on web pages or phishing attacks in email or shortened URLs in Twitter, you might end up getting a Trojan horse on your computer, and people might be logging all your keystrokes and all your passwords.
Wow.
So
yeah.
There are all sorts of things that could go on, and it's best to be, I think being somewhat paranoid is a good thing.
Well, going back to proxy servers, personally, I enjoy proxy server hopping a little bit, to get around some of the, restrictions on U.S. content or something like that. But one thing you often see in the hacker movies, you'll see the little map visualized on the screen, and you'll see the connection jumping from one country to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. It'll be bouncing all around the world. After you get through, maybe two or three jumps, is there actually any way that somebody on the other end can start tunneling through, trying to trace you back through 20 connections, or is that kind of just Hollywood?
I think that's mostly Hollywood. For the most part, the internet was designed to be a communication network between trusted hosts. It was designed by the government as ARPANET originally, and then it evolved eventually over 20 or 30 years into the internet that we know today. And it wasn't designed with this security in mind. So our email is very, very simplistic language that's used to establish the connections. And that's why we have a hard time distinguishing between legitimate email and email that comes from spammers who are pretending to be our friends. Web pages are somewhat more secure with HTTPS, but I'll give you an example. At work, we have a proxy server. Everybody that's on our internal network has to go through the proxy server to reach the internet. So from the internet side, everybody appears to be coming from one IP address. Now, you would think that that would anonymize everybody inside. But when you go to Google, Google will pass you a cookie that sits on your computer. And then anytime you do something with Google, Google knows that that's your computer.
Google doesn't
know
everything.
And not one of another. Yeah, well, Google is... maybe sort of the big brother today, but they know, they're like Santa Claus, right? They know who's been naughty and nice. They know where you're going, they know what you're doing, and I think their rationale is that they can make money by tracking where you go and delivering up Google ads that entice you to buy things.
Well,
so it's not really anonymous, even though you are going through proxies.
Well, how much work would it be to actually be anonymous, completely anonymous?
Well, There are services out there that you can establish a secure encrypted tunnel to, and then do things from there. And if you're also, you know, scrubbing cookies and have other things going on your computer to keep them from tracking you, then you can be pretty anonymous. And typically, those are services that you have to pay for, and you're then sending your credit card information or going through PayPal and paying some rather nefarious people who are operating there on the dark side. Well, they might justify that what they're doing is providing a service so that Big Brother can't tell where you are. And, you know, I certainly respect that. That sort of an ethos goes back to the original way that we thought about hackers, which was open source is good. Sharing things is good. You know, we're not in this to profit or snoop or be mean. This is an intellectual thing, and we're all one big community. And that's sort of a respectable thing. And so the Electronic Freedom Foundation has a lot of information on open source. Instead of copyright, they promote copyleft. They promote, you know, open sharing of code and other things on the internet. And so, you know, that's a good thing. And being able to be anonymous is going to be harder and harder as we go forward. I think you can sort of tell that's the trend. That, you know, there may be commercial reasons or there may be reasons that the government wants to snoop. And some of the projects the government's had in recent years have sounded pretty scary.
We actually have a caller on the line.
Hi, Nathan.
Hello. So my question for you, North Session, is have you ever phone phreaked? And if so, do you have a Captain Crunch whistle?
I do not have a Captain Crunch whistle, although I know who you're speaking about, and I'm very familiar with phone phreaking. I have a friend who.
Sorry to just jump in.
Freshman in college.
Just to jump in, sorry.
Actually, excuse me.
Oh, we're kind of looking at each other. I don't think we actually know what the phone.
Yeah, can you explain? Yeah,
okay. Freaking? Okay, I'll go back.
Thank
so,
you.
So, starting in the 1960s, I think an underground group culture developed, and this was people who were getting back to talking about sort of that. The geeky curiosity that a lot of us have. And at the time, people didn't have personal computers. Computers were actually very, very expensive, big pieces of equipment. I remember back in the 1970s, if you bought a Cray, they gave you a building to go with it as an accessory. So, I mean, computers were a big deal. They were very expensive. I remember a quote from, I don't remember if it was IBM, but there was a quote from someplace in the 1950s saying that it's possible that someday the world might need as many as 5 computers. You know, the things were going bigger and bigger back then. And a lot of security was through obscurity. And so one of the biggest networks at the time, because network computing hadn't really been invented, was the phone system, Ma Bell. So Ma Bell had this huge network of copper all over the world, and it was an intellectual challenge to try to figure out how this all worked without, you know, it wasn't open source. And so anyhow, the phone freakers figured out how to use tones to place long-distance calls, and often they would place long-distance calls to South America or Germany or Australia or someplace that was exotic. And the people who were, you know, long distance was very expensive. And so they weren't doing anything malicious. Oftentimes it was sort of like a bulletin board or like Twitter. They were just getting together and chatting, and they would get to know one another. And it was a really cool thing. But, you know, it was about 40 years before Twitter came along. And the FBI and Ma Bell, you know, made these guys out to be quite bad guys, even though they really were pretty benign. So, you know, they were very curious, and it was like a big maze. How do you figure out what the codes are and how to get from here to there? And it was sort of the, you know, Ma Bell was like a big dungeon, I guess. And, you know, you figure out the rules, and it was quite neat. But I have a friend from college who had a little run-in with the FBI when he was in high school, because in the late 70s, he was participating with sort of that underground, and he wasn't doing very much, but we did learn a little bit about how some of that works in the around that time frame.
All right. If you, audience, have a cybersecurity or hacker-oriented question for Null Session, the number to phone is 780-492-2577, extension 1. Let's talk a bit about movies again, because one of the things that the show does is tries to compare movies to real life. So I watched The Net. And that was an interesting movie.
Did you just about say, and that hurt me?
It did. It actually hurt me, because I hadn't seen it before. And in addition to the 1995 computer graphics that made my eyes bleed, is it actually possible for someone to delete your identity or to give you a new one?
Well, the premise of that movie was that the bad guy scared... This is a spoiler if you haven't seen this 15-year-old movie.
Oh, please don't. Please. Whatever you do, honestly.
Don't spoil it?
Oh, no. Do go ahead. Spoil it, please.
The bad guy was going to convince the government and the public that all these bad things were going on. And he was selling basically antivirus software. And so you would put his security software on your computers, and then you'd be secure. Well, he had a back door, and so he was able to actually control everybody's computers. And that meant that he could control traffic lights, he could control the DMV, he could control, water and power. He had all the ability to control these things because he basically conned these people to put his software legitimately on their computers.
Right.
And so that would be very difficult to do, but it's the kind of thing that the Chinese government has recently been suggesting. The Chinese government's very interested in controlling what people do, what they say, and preventing them from going places that they don't want them to go or talking to people that they don't want them to talk with. And so they've suggested that, you know, to be helpful to prevent cybersecurity badness, that they would put the government's security software on all of their computers.
Well, that's friendly.
Well, it's really the same exact plot as this 15-year-old movie.
Just so everyone knows, if you've been listening to our affiliates in China, you just heard the Chinese theme song playing for the last 3 minutes. We can't explain why. we do have another caller on. They wish to remain anonymous, like our guest Null Session. Are you there, guest?
Yes. Okay, that's me. I had to turn my radio off. I just want to say a couple things. My dad was actually a freaker, and basically we just did it, or he showed me how to do it to get free calls back.
Nice.
Like a long time ago, about 15, no, it'd be 20 years ago now. Wow, I'm old. He would use, actually, hold on, I got to turn off the Bluetooth so I can hear what you're saying back to me. One sec.
We are highly technically adept here.
He would unscrew the handset and touch the metal part of the speaker to the metal, and he grounded on the actual phone base, and then you could make a call anywhere. It was quite cool that they got rid of that pretty fast. Also, we'll say about remaining anonymous. I'm wondering if your guest has heard of... what's it called? The Cypherpunk Type 2 Remailer System. It's like a network of servers which put an encryption encapsulation on your message, and each server puts a new layer of encryption on it, and it is probably the only way to remain anonymous. And basically, in essence, it would be like using a post office, like putting, like snail mail, we put our mail into an envelope and we seal it. Well, if we had an actual remailer network that was running smoothly, then we would actually protect ourselves from any sort of exposure on the net. And but the government doesn't want to. They quashed that in 96 with the Telecommunications Reform Act and put classified encryption as munitions. So it was actually illegal to send an encryption code across the internet if it crossed the U.S. border. So, they do not want us to have freedom of speech on the internet, for sure. Not just China, but our government's involved, the U.S. is where it started. And, we'll just live with it and enjoy the non-privacy.
Caller, you just, honestly, you might as well have spoken Swahili for the last 5 minutes.
I understood, but thank you, caller. This actually kind of reminds me of my grandfather's perspective of this on the world. He basically goes by, he doesn't really have that much to hide, really, and so what does he care if people know blank for the most part when it comes to the most elements of his life? He says he doesn't do anything wrong. There's nothing to hide. So that's kind of one way to look at it.
Well, you know, that's an argument. A lot of people will advocate transparency rather than going towards anonymity, everybody making everything available and going for transparency. And, I've heard that argument before. I'm not sure that I could convince some of the people that I work with of that, but I have a lot of information about me on the web, and I don't care. And a lot of people don't care. There's a big cyber criminal underground that's selling not just, you know, credit cards, but identities. And a lot of people need to be motivated, really, to protect things better and put in more work, and they really don't want to put in more work because they know that their liability, if their credit card is stolen, is limited to $50. The bank is going to cover them here in the United States. Now, that's not true in Europe, but that's the way that things are here in the U.S., and so the consumer doesn't really have a motivation to seek out better security, which maybe is too bad. But if you're interested in the topic of backdoors and a nefarious government who wants to listen to everything that you do, Sneakers is also a very good movie.
That was a great movie. And actually, we'll talk about that a bit more right after the break.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about astrobiology with Dr. Maggie Turnbull. Dr. Turnbull is an expert on habstars, stars that could potentially be habitable. What's the real deal on life on other planets? And what exactly does life mean anyway? If it is out there, how do we find it? Join us in the search on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Hi, Phil Plait from the Bad Astronomy blog here. I'm also president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. And when I was asked to do a public service announcement for this, I was trying to think, you know, what should I talk about? Should I talk about specific fallacies like post hoc ergo propter hoc, just because something happens after something else, they must be related? Correlation not being causation, just because two things happen doesn't mean they're related. You know, could I talk about this fallacy or that fallacy? And I thought, you know, you can go to the randi.org website, or you can go to the Skeptic Society website, or CFI, or any of those places, get all sorts of specific information about the way thinking goes wrong. But you know what? All I want to tell you here is to exhort you to think. Just think. When you see something, when you hear something, if it doesn't sound right, think about it. That's really all it takes. That's the first step, thinking. And then when you start doing it, you find out you're going to like doing it and you're going to want to do it more and you will do it more. And then you can go and look around and find out all the specifics about how logic works and how science works and how skepticism works and where it goes wrong and how you can talk to your friends about it and how the television lies to you and politicians lie to you and everybody lies to you and all that stuff. But the first step, the very first step, the thing you got to do is think. Just think. Thanks.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We are here with Null Session talking about cybersecurity, late 90s internet catastrophe movies, can we call them that? And actually next, how your boss could figure out that you're just sitting in your office all day commenting on people's blogs. The number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So we've talked about movies and what they the hackers can't do, but what can they do? What is the most common way that a hacker would get into the system?
Well, I think that most most hackers today are script kiddies, or they're going to come at you with social engineering. Social engineering is really a weak point because, you know, we pay a lot of attention to our antivirus and our firewalls and all these other things, and we build up these big barriers. But then when somebody calls and says, you know, I'm from the phone company and I'm trying to troubleshoot the line and your computer account keeps quitting and I need to fix that for you, can you give me your password? Or, you know, that's social engineering. If somebody who has, can roll a 20 on the charisma dice, gives you a call. Sorry about that.
No,
record.
No.
I never played a lot of D&D myself, but social engineering is a real threat, and it's a lot easier to, for example, put CDs or DVDs around. Leave a DVD in the bathroom at some company. You know, you go in, you say, boy, can I use your restroom? You leave it in there. It's got a Trojan file on it. And you take a marker, and on the outside you write, important files, you know, how to break the lottery, Pamela Anderson. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
You know, you put something on there that's going to entice people to stick it in their computer, and you drop that around, and you're going to have a bunch of passwords. You're going to have control, perhaps, of desktops inside computers, and you just bypassed these big expensive firewalls that they have.
Well, how about botnets? Now, Jim in Phoenix, thank you, Jim, sent me actually quite an accessible explanation of these tiny little computer zombies. So, can you explain to the audience what those are?
We had an issue that a virus earlier this year that you may have heard of called the Configure virus. Just to back up a little bit, how some of these spread. And so Configure, or the SQL Slammer virus, maybe you heard about that. That was the virus that spread through SQL ports that were unpatched, and it infected 75,000 computers in 10 minutes back in 2003. These viruses spread, and they drop payloads that will, you know, they might have timed instructions where, for example, they want to create a denial of service and all make requests against whitehouse.gov at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the botnets work in unison, and sometimes, you know, you can use the word zombies. You can use zombies. The bad guys can pretend to be coming through your computer, sort of using your computer as a proxy, if we want to use that example.
Okay, so what are they after? Like, when somebody hacks a computer, what are they usually after?
I think they're after, you know, it used to be an intellectual game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when new technologies come out, there are a lot of people who are curious and want to figure out how it works and how to break it and how to use it, and it's intellectual.
And that's wonderful. I encourage that kind of behavior.
For sure. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's natural. You want to learn about it, and that's normal. You also have the people who have developed it that want to be very protective of it, and we know how the record industry was very protective of, putting encryption and trying to protect music so that it couldn't be pirated. And that's the kind of thing that happens when new technologies come out. Laws don't exist. Technology doesn't exist to protect them. People are curious. Although over time, the people who continue to come up with these attacks are not necessarily the curious kids in someone's basement. It tends to be criminals, and the criminals are looking for things that they can sell. And so they'll find things on your computer that they can sell, or maybe they'll use your computer to launch an attack against a company. And then when the company comes after, they're going to come after you and sue you for attacking them. And meanwhile, this other guy is able to sort of make these attacks in anonymity. And then if he finds something at a big company, then he can sell that. And so, you know, credit cards can be very valuable. You know, selling credit cards, selling identities, there is a market for that. But probably one of the biggest threats is, as companies get bigger, you think of Bank of America, or you think of some of these big data brokerages or credit bureaus, They process millions and millions and millions of consumer transactions every day. And so when there's a data breach at a Bank of America, there could be millions of consumer identities lost. Or if there's an insider who sells something, or if a tape goes missing when it gets shipped from point A to point B because it wasn't encrypted and it wasn't handled properly. So, you know, they're interested in you, but I think they would rather get a little bigger bang for the buck if they could. But the botnets have their place. I think that the goal of the criminals is they would like to get their virus spread out as widely as they can, and then sort of like spam and phishing and all of that, you know, there's a lot of money to be made, and they make it in volume, and not everybody's stupid.
Right.
You know, but a lot of people, you know, a lot of smart people, a lot of people who have vice president in their title still click on things because they want somebody to love them, and they get an email that says, I love you, and they click on it.
Well, I have an interesting one, something that just came up actually in the JREF chat room. It's in regards to when there's still the issue when you're crossing the border with your laptop, where it can be seized and searched. What about keeping your you know, even on the offline world, so to speak, keeping your data secure in that realm?
And just for those listeners who don't know, the JREF chat room?
It's the James Randi Educational Foundation. The actual address, I believe, was randy.org/chat, but I could be wrong there, and I'm sure I'll be corrected very soon if I was. So I'm on it there through IRC. So for our technical listeners, they know what I'm talking about. Everyone else, it's whooshing over their head, I think. So, your thoughts on the offline security laptops?
Let's see. There's a couple things in there. If you cross the border, they have the right to demand your password and demand that you decrypt your hard drive. And working for a corporation, our answer is you shouldn't be traveling with particularly sensitive things on your hard drive. You know, as an individual, you might want to, you know, find it. You know, we really haven't talked about what encryption is, but encryption is using an algorithm so that it would potentially take hundreds of thousands of years for somebody to break the code and figure out, you know, the message. And so if you use reputable encryption, then you might want to keep that online someplace. And there are lots of cloud services and you know, services like Gmail, where if you do have your own encryption and keep it there, then you'll have access to it when you get where you're going. Or you might keep it on the corporate network, and then when you get where you're going, you might use a VPN, which is a secure connection back to your company. So don't travel with something that's particularly sensitive. Don't travel with, you know, naked pictures of your dog on your computer.
You?
I have naked pictures of my dog on my computer, I'm sorry.
I suspect I might as well. we have another question via Twitter here. What's more secure, Mac's PCs or Linux? I assume by PC they must mean Windows.
This is going to break out in a fist fight, yeah, regardless.
And now
this
we leave the studio
good,
running in hiding.
That's a good question. And I want to say that you know, Microsoft gets a bad rap, but Microsoft has put a lot of effort into securing their code. However, they still have, you know, many vulnerabilities that they patch every month. So Apple has vulnerabilities that they patch every month. The recent Safari update had lots of patches for security holes. And so when you write large programs, some percentage of the code is going to be faulty. And some of those defects can lead to security holes. And that's just inherent with these programs that are bigger and bigger and bigger. When I started writing, you know, programs on a TRS-80 around 1980, we had to store things on a cassette, and we could only store maybe a program that was a couple K, kilobytes, not very big. And so when you have smaller code, you know, you can really go through it, and you can check it, and you can feel very confident that it doesn't have any vulnerabilities. But when you have code that has millions and millions of lines, you know, you do the best that you can, and then later on when you find mistakes, you fix them. And so the Macs are secure because they're obscure. They're not as much of a target. When there's money to be made and there are more people using Macs, they're going to be more of a target, and they are a growing target. In addition, with web services, with Flash and Silverlight and Shockwave and, you know, all these different things that you can run, Google Gears, on your computer, independent of the platform, people can attack you through your web browser. Then it no longer makes a difference whether you're on a Mac or a PC. It's just because the Macs are less of a target, they're more likely to try to download an .exe file, which won't run on your Mac, and then you're lucky you don't get, you know, exploited. If that makes sense.
So besides, you know, buying a Mac, what else can people do to avoid hackers?
I don't think the Mac is going to be the long-term solution, but I like my Mac, and it's very pretty, and it has lots of colors and all that. I like the Macs a lot more from the beginning because, you know, the PCs were blocky and ugly, and I'm really into the aesthetics. But
you realize when I quote you later.
What was your question? What can people do to be protected?
Yes.
If you have secrets, encrypt them. But watch that movie, Sneakers. The problem is you have lots of secrets. And if we look at the Twitter hack that maybe you guys have heard about,
right,
or, you know, I'll just talk about that a little bit. Here's a guy who was an employee at Twitter, and he had a fairly simple password. And he was using the same password in multiple places. Let me pull down this tab here in my browser, and I must have 40. Now, I don't use them all, but I must have 40 different social media services out there, social networking things, you know, Ping and LinkedIn and Blogger and Facebook and YouTube and MySpace and Google and Flickr and PhotoBucket and TwitPic and Geeks and Plaxo and Dig, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. And how do you remember a different password for each one? Well, you don't want to have to look up a password, and so you tend to have a few passwords. So if somebody is able to find a service that will allow you to keep trying passwords until one works, then if they find that password, or if they're a lucky guesser, then it's likely that some of these other 40 or 50 services out there are going to use the same password, and then they'll be able to get on that account. And so then if they can get on your Google account and you're not encrypting things, then they might have sensitive information, which is what happened in the case of Twitter. They got a hold of company documents that were sensitive that shouldn't have been put out there on Google.
Another important thing, too, when your email gets hacked is that if you've ever forgotten your password, you've clicked the link, click here to reset my password, and it emails you the link so that you can then reset. So that's opening a big can of worms if your email gets exposed.
You want to be particularly careful about your email. That's true. But in general, that is a weak link because many times, you know, even banks will ask pretty innocuous questions. They'll say, what's your favorite sport? He's a big guy. Maybe he likes football. You know, they'll ask, what was your mother's maiden name? Well, some of this stuff you can look up. And if you have information on Facebook and MySpace and Twitter, and, you know, you can go out and data mine an individual, and you can piece together their whole life story. You can find out their first girlfriend, you know, their first dog, their mother's name, their father's name, when they were born. You can get all this information from all these different places, and then you piece it together, and you have a very good chance that you can go around and use things like the forgot password and break into their accounts. That's a very, you know, they put a lot of security. They make you say,
right,
make you use 8 characters and an uppercase and lowercase and numbers and exclamation points and all this other stuff. And then they have forgot past, and they say, what was your dog's first name?
Yeah.
Well, that's...
Yeah, we're pretty much heading to the end of the hour here.
So that's all the time we have for today. And thanks very much to Null Session for being here.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Session.
And to everyone who called and emailed, thanks very much. And thanks, as always, to Sean for the on-air production and Ryan for his phone answering awesomeness. And if you like this program, please do go to iTunes and write a review. It takes only a minute, and it makes me very happy. So that's it for now, and we will see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. Sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see, and everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie.
Everything you believe is a lie.